Mr. Eagles, Reel 1. I think you were saying you came from Nuneaton?
No, I don't care. I was at Nuneaton. I come from Gloucester. But I was in Nuneaton at the time that Coventry got badly burnt.
Can you tell me what you remember of that?
Well, I can remember that night the sky was absolutely red, brilliant red. And we're at that fire, of course, from Coventry. And we were a scout troop. And we were camping on the banks of the canal. And first thing in the morning, of course, our scout master took us into Coventry to see if we could do any help messages or things like that, although we didn't know where anywhere it was. But when we got there, the police said no, that the services were managing quite adequately, and frankly, we'd probably been in the way. But they did thank us for it. We just trudled back then to the camp at night.
What did the bombing, what did the Coventry look like from a distance?
Oh, terrible. When we got into, well, to the outskirts of Coventry, we didn't let us go right in. It was awful. It was just, like you see on the television now sometimes, when this place is burnt out, and all charred, everything was charred, it was flat. And we could see what was a cathedral was still smouldering. Smoke was still coming from that. And all the houses. But I believe it's because a lot of the houses were wood construction, or wood based. It was a very old part of Coventry, apparently, that got burned.
Did any bombs fall on Nuneaton?
No. Not that I remember, anyway. It was nearly all incendiaries on Coventry. There was bombs, of course, the bombing. But it seemed to be that from a distance you see it, all the flashes and that, and then it was all red. But you could judge that it was incendiary bombs, more than actual heavy bombs. There were pipe bombs as well. But from what we'd seen before, it didn't appear to be that many bombs, but all incendiaries. And of course, they would come down in sticks of them. So that would have been the reason why the sky was red, as was Bristol when they got burned, because I was in Gloucester and I saw that from Reservoir Camp, which is on the hill, and Wandsworth Hill. And we watched that. And that was both of them, because we looked straight down the Severn, you see. And see Bristol in the distance, and that was, you could hear the thump and everything, 36 miles away.
Was that after Coventry?
Yes, I think it was. Or it may have been around the same time.
Which looked the worst, Coventry or Bristol?
Well, I didn't go into Bristol, but I went as far as we could, allowed to go into Coventry. Although I understand that Bristol was very heavily bombed. I'm not qualified to say really which was the worst. They both looked very, very heavy. In fact, probably, if anything, Coventry probably suffered more, mainly because the incendiaries, isn't it?
Do you have any other Second World War memories as a child living through it?
Yes, although I told you I came from Gloucester, which you would think would be a fairly safe place to be in, and London children did get evacuated there, but on one occasion when Gloucester Aerodrome got bombed and stuffed, just as they were changing over ships, which was a Gloucester aircraft company where they were making planes. In fact, they were working on the Gloucester Meteor, the first jet. And an awful lot of people got killed at that time, but I didn't see that. What I did say, we were in the playground in the school when we got struck. Plane came over, a long plane. Didn't drop any bombs. Maybe Dolly dropped his bombs, I suppose. And they came and just struck us. And we had shelters in the plane. Well, of course, there was no chance for us to get into them. But as far as I remember, no one was seriously ill. One child, I think, was a bit shrapnel or something, but certainly got
Do you think it was deliberate strafing of the playground?
Oh, I thought so. When he came over the houses, it very, very low. And whether he just saw people and just decided to strafe, whether he... I wouldn't have thought he would have been able to pick them out as children and such. But it was a lot of people, of course, were just playing in the playground. So he wouldn't have been honest, I thought. Of course, we were all very angry and all. I remember all the parents and people who lost to be very angry about it. Thankfully, no one's killed.
How old do you think you might have been then?
Well, let's go at 14, so I would have been about 12 or 13. I was trying to think. My grandma says it could have been between 12 and 13.
You were born in 28?
Born in 28. Yeah.
So it was the early part of the war?
It was really.
How did you come to be in the forces yourself?
I volunteered for the army in 1945 when I was 17.
Why did you do that?
Because I always wanted to be a Gloucester. I've always been an ambition of mine as a child. Whenever I saw the regimental band or the troops as a child, I would march alongside and my cousin. My grandfather, who I never knew, got killed in the First War with the regiment, you see. And, I just wanted to be one of them. To me, it was, I'm a Gloucester, just a kid, I wanted to go to.
Was the war still on when you volunteered?
Just about to finish. I just finished, in fact, because it finished on the 15th of August, at the war in Japan. And I volunteered on the 18th. I went up on my own, and they put my age on. I had a medical, and then signed on the 16th of October, 45. So the war was actually over.
Where did you go to before you went to Korea?
I was stationed at Mark Eaton Park Camp. Training battalion there. And then I went to Colchester to Germany. The regiment was in Berlin in the 5th Guards Brigade. That's where I joined them. There was a 2nd Coldstream, 2nd Grenadiers, and 2nd Gloucesters were part of the 5th Guards Brigade, that time stationed in Berlin. From there, we came back to Gloucester. I went to Bermuda to Jamaica back home. There's a few months with the Royal Hampshire Regiment, and because I was a qualified drummer then, and they had no regulars in the four drums in the Royal Hampshire Regiment. So that war office was posted there. But as soon as the regiment came back from Jamaica, because I came on a fight with me, which is 3 years abroad. And they reclaimed me. So they were at Colchester. So we joined them there. And from there, I went to Korea.
When was that?
We left on the 3rd of October, 1950. Arrived, I think it was the 5th of the 10th of November. 10th, I think, of November.
What? Did you arrive at Busan?
Yes, I did arrive at Busan.
In which ship?
The Windrush.
And what reception did you get at Busan?
Well, it was American band there. I think anyone will tell you about this. Every ship come in got this American marching band with a band as soon as the phone them. It was great, the troops come marching in. All the John Philip Sousa stuff, it was great as well. And they met us, greeted us. Children, Korean children, of course, and people would greet us, waving Union Jacks for us. For our sakes, I suppose the Americans, they got the Stars and Stripes. But for us, they waved the flag. And they found us on these trains. We call them trains. They had no windows in, just wooden seats, you know. So we just piled our kit bags in between them and just laid on top of them. It was very uncomfortable. And we then went up to, I think it was Taegu from there. And, but that was an uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. But it gave us an insight of what was to come, really.
What were your first impressions of Korea?
Well, not very complimentary. It was almost medieval, I would have said. Looking at the place and the way the people were, when you would see, mostly it was refugees that we saw, but the first part of Montaigu, that wasn't. But to see these mainly old men and old women and children, because all the young men were in the army or in services. And to see this man walking in front and his wife walking behind him carrying all his luggage, you know, he didn't carry anything, just smoking his old pipe. It seemed ludicrous to us, incongruous really, but that was the way. It was very, very medieval. I thought that the place smelled terribly. That was an impression I think all of us got, was a smell, because they had no sewage as such, and all the excrement was, all the sewage was stored onto for growing. It was a compost. So as you went along the roads, on either side was on the paddy fields and whatever else was growing there, not seemed to be growing in those days. It was the smell. I think that smell stayed with you, I think.
Were you a member of a particular company?
I was headquarters company of the Gloucester Children.
And what rank did you hold then?
I was a drummer.
How long was it before you went into the line?
We went into the line, but I didn't do actually any fighting when we got near Sinanju on the way up. This is just after the Chinese apparently come in. We were told that what we had to do was we dug in, and then we were given an order to come from General Brodie to say that we had to hold this line, and we stayed there. And then in the middle of the night, they said, come on, we have to go until we meet transport. Well, I believe that we marched all night in single file through a blizzard. Our water bottles on our hips froze, so if we wanted, all you did, you just chopped it with your bayonet to get some ice to suck if you were going along. It was really very, very cold. And there was fighting going on the side. You could see it, you could see the flashes, you could hear the fighting, but we weren't hit at all on that, but we went 17 miles. The great thing about it, I think, was our colonel, Joe Conn. He continuously was walking up and down. We were a single file either side of the road, and he was walking down encouraging us all the time. Brilliant. Him and his bodyguard, which was Sergeant Major Fred Stone, at the APTC, and they were encouraged us all the way. Well, if somebody needed a bit of help, I was a brain gunner at that time. My number two was a reservist, who was quite older than me, and his job was to carry the spare barrel and the ammunition, you see, the boxes of ammunition. But he said to me, could you carry some more to help relieve him? So I carried the ammunition and the magazines. But it was a long way, so it's never going to end. It was really bitterly cold. That night, we slept in a pigsty. It had been cleaned out, of course. But it was a pigsty, nevertheless. And I think it was probably the best sleep I've ever had in my life. what we did, a young National Service man who was coming after me, but we went to school together. We lived in the same street, you see, so we piled up, and I was sort of, I was like a big brother, I suppose, to him. And we had four blankets, two blankets each, and we put two on these, two on the top of us, and we cuddled up, and we slept really like a log until dawn when we opened up. That was really something. Then from there we went to Pyongyang. We were at the outskirts of Pyongyang at that time. And we were then guarding the bridges, the two bridges, as it was rather called. And there was we had a Centurion tank with us, and our job was to guard the bridges, stop people coming across. I mean, the refugees still coming from the bridges. They weren't allowed to use the bridges.
Why was that?
So that our old stuff could come across, so that the traffic, you know, was still trucks and things coming by. So the idea was to keep it clear for them. Which we did, and then the engineers blew the bridges, and we had to stay with them until that had been done.
Did the refugees obey you?
Well, some didn't, and we had to shoot them. That was our orders. I don't know if they killed them, but most of them were shot, and that was enough for them to stop.
How many?
A few. Because mostly the other saw what was happening, so they stopped. And in fact, they tried to cross, and did cross the river, not by the bridge, but by the river itself.
Were they allowed to cross the river itself?
Oh yes, there's nothing to stop them crossing the river. The thing was to keep it open until all our transport got across, and then it was to be blown, you see, and we didn't want to blow them up, as it were, so it was really for their own good. So we didn't actually fire at them, but who knows how accurate you are. It's all part of the war as it is.
Was this before or after Christmas?
This was before Christmas, yes.
But December?
This was sort of late November, because we got on the 10th or 11th of November, and this was about, I suppose, the end of November. I know this is on the retreat from Pyongyang, because we were the last from there, you see, because having blown the bridges, we were then the last to leave. On the way back, our truck was stopped, and Captain Farrell Hockley, who was our adjutant, said to John Major, I want two men. So we got John, George, and myself, who was at the other end. And we got off the truck and said there was a three-tonner right there on the side that was busted. And in the back was five motorcycles, all broken. Another one broke, but Captain Farrelly said that there was a tank transporter coming through with A Company, who were the last company, and that we could get a tow from them. Our job was to get it back. So we said, okay, fine. Well, when A Company came through, not only did they already have a lorry on the tank truck, they were towing one as well. And they said, I'm sorry, no way they can do it. You better come with us and we'll talk. And I said, no, we'll talk. Because we didn't want to incur the wrath of our adjutant. We knew him well, and didn't want to upset him. So we kept asking the people, Americans were coming through, and eventually a 2.5-tonner truck with an eagle in it, and he said, I'm the last. He said, you have to come. I said, well, look, have you got a tow rope? He said, yes. I said, well, can you tow us? Yes, he said. So this was the middle of the night, of course. Goodness knows what time it was. It was dark, yes, it was. And he told us. When we went to say, I expected Jonas to jump up there, you see. Because I didn't drive. He said, I don't drive. So anyway, I jumped up and he had the ammunition, the guns. And he told us through, and I tell you, it was a nightmare ride. It really was. Because all we could see was his tail lights. And that, through the dust that was coming up, wasn't always easy. And sometimes there'd just be a black void down below, as you know, as it was frightening. And eventually we reached the lines of the American, I think it was the 27th Regiment, because they were called the Wolfhounds. That was their nickname. I'm sure it was the 27th. And they gave us some food and things. Then during the day, I went out with a truck driver with huge barrels of fuel for the tanks. So I went with a shotgun each day out to fuel up the tanks. And then when I came back one day, the three tonner had gone, and so had John's. Apparently, the drum major had come back with another one. And told him off with a message, well, the Eagles can make his own feedback. So he obviously didn't know how long it was going to be. And then Hank went out this morning. He said, I'll go out early. He said, wait for me. So I said, okay, fine. So they were moving out. I didn't notice it at the time. They were moving out. Bugging out of the field. So the top sergeant said to me, look, Hank's not back yet, we're moving out. I said, well, I'll wait for him. He said, well, I shouldn't wait for him. I said, well, I'll wait for him. I'll wait for him. So anyway, I think you should get him. So I got on the truck with all the stuff loaded up. And I got up down again and said, look, I told Hank I'd wait for him, so I'll wait for him. Because he's going to be on his own, otherwise he can't be on his way back. I could still be waiting for him. He never arrived. I was getting worried at one stage that everybody pulled out, you see. And it was coming through then, the refugees. And away after, I don't know, an hour or two, it seemed to me that he wasn't coming. And an old Korean elder, black cloaks and these tall black hats and long beard. Pipers and he says, Chungwa, come, you, go. So.
What was he referring to?
Chinese were coming. And I would be sensible, I would go and hang around. So I thought, well, that makes sense to me. I've been an idiot waiting here anyway.
Where was the spot?
I don't know. Honestly, don't know. It was. I suppose it was about, as I recall, I don't know how far we got out of Pyongyang when we stopped. And then we went back to his line. I think it was, Hank said it was about 60 miles that he took us. But I don't know. I mean, it seemed an awful long time. It was all through the night, you know. Anyway, I just saw a couple to walk out of this village that we were in. I heard an explosion, so I went to the top, and there was the bridge had just been blown, and there was the sappers driving off. So I whistled to them, shouted to them, but they obviously weren't interested. And off they went. It was American engineers, it wasn't our engineers. And so that was the start of a journey for me. I had to make my own way back alongside the refugees. And had some quite a few experiences on that.
Can you tell me about them?
Yes. One of them, I met a captain in the Korean Army with his family. He was bringing them back. The South Korean Army, of course. And we got to a spot where somebody was firing on everybody who came along, you know. So he said, look, I'll go put on this radio door. And it was obviously just one person. So all I had was a phosphorus grenade. Stuff like that, everything had gone with the truck. And the carbine that I'd been using with Hank was still on his truck. So anyway, when we got around, we saw this, I don't know what nationality, it was South Korean or North Korean or what it was, but he was fine, he had this old rifle. And the captain came outside and I came behind and threw the phosphorus grenade. And when he jumped up, he burned him and he captured him. We thought, well, he'll have his rifle, but of course, as a man killer, there's no friends. He obviously used to put his ammunition, so that was no good to us. And then on that time, obviously, the captain's family was giving the apples, so he was living on apples. That's what they were at time. And I met up with a group of young Christians in a town, just outside a town, I don't know what town it was. And they said, come with us, and we went into a building, and we all sort of, like a dormitory, and we were all lying down there. And suddenly somebody woke up and said, come on quickly, the Chinese are coming. So we dashed out, and there was a river across. And I said, what happened to you here? And this girl said, you follow me, you stand behind me, put your feet where I put my feet. And just below the water were stepping stones. So they obviously knew it. And I crossed that way, and then we just got across the river. I think everybody got through, all this group of people, when we heard the Chinese in the shape of, well, the sound of horses. Yeah, horses there, and they come, and then there was shooting and things going on, and this Korean girl said to me, we mustn't be caught by them. He said, her sister and a friend had been caught, and they'd been raped and then shot. And they had no intention of being caught, they'd rather kill themselves than be caught. After a while, they were slow, so I decided to move on. And then on one occasion, we were hopefully getting near our own lines. And I saw a shooting star, which was an American plane, F-111, I think. And it was coming around, and as it came down along this, we were then on the straight, flat area. And it seemed to be firing. I thought, oh, well, they're not really shooting these people, obviously. They're doing blanks just to frighten the people away. My goodness, suddenly I felt him whizzing past.